Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs, Stanley Good, Answers, and Seek Justice. An author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. It's important, if you're a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered yourself for a segment on a future show, please email us with your name and contact information to thecrimewire@gmail.com. You know, I think that we all don't understand the minds behind serial killers and what happens and criminology and crimes affecting the news and the media. And I think that you're going to be especially enlightened tonight by tonight's special guest, Dr. Scott Bond. He's a criminology and sociology professor at Drew University. Dr. Scott Bond is not your average academic, and if you read his blog every day, you will know at docbond.com on his website, his expertise runs the gamut, including white crime, state crime, serial killers, media, how it affects our society. His research really examines how and why the public forms its beliefs on complex issues such as murder, domestic violence, capital punishment, war, terrorism. He is the author of Mass Deception. He is someone who has really changed, in my opinion, views on crimes, on these killers. He's appeared on programs from Dr. Drew, CNN, Nancy Grace. He's appeared on Burl Bear Show. He is someone who is noted in the area. Dr. Scott Bond, welcome, sir, to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. It's great to be here.
I think that we should begin with, you know, and it's actually about a blog that you wrote, and it's how the managers of the state and news media influence the public agenda. Do we have a public agenda?
Well, I think we certainly do, and I think that the agenda changes. And the crux of my blog that you are talking about is based upon my own experience working in the media. Before I became an academic, before I became a college professor, I worked for more than 20 years, as you know, Susan, in the media world. And, for example, I was a vice president at NBC, and I saw how the news is created. And the news is created very much as an entertainment product, and it's presented that way. And it's done in a very stylized fashion, in a way to sensationalize events and create controversy and intrigue. And the was going so far as to say that the goal is not objective reporting; it is really sensationalism. And
you make a good argument here, or a point, and you say that media may not be successful in telling people what to think, but they are stunningly successful in telling people what to think about. I've never heard that before.
Exactly. And that's what's known as agenda setting. And simply if you give any topic enough volume and enough rhetoric behind it, it's going to take center stage as the topic of the day, whether it be the conversation around the water cooler or the conversation that makes all the headlines. And that could be when the Bush administration was pounding the war drums toward Iraq. Every day we heard about weapons of mass destruction, or it can be something as mundane and really unimportant as whether Britney Spears has gained 5 pounds, you know, in the last 6 months. I mean, crazy things that become all important. Charlie Sheen's exploits last year became just an amazingly overwhelming news story, and it was really much ado about nothing, but yet it was thrust upon us as important news.
Can I ask you, you know, and I know that so much has been on overload with Kaylee Anthony and the trial and everything that took place. Was it the media that drove public's opinion? Was it the media, do you think? You know, you had a long, drawn-out conversation, dialogue, attack, and it was before the jury had even started being picked, before a jury then had weighed in on the decision, that, you know, there were crime shows out there that really hit this hard night after night after night when there were other children missing that you didn't see reported about. You saw them just continuously give their opinions on this one case. Do you think that that really goes towards hurting a case, not allowing justice to prevail correctly?
Well, I think that absolutely publicity, pretrial publicity, can influence cases, and that's why there's actually protections against it in the Bill of Rights, but with a speedy trial. But at the same time, the problem is certain cases become we like to call it in criminal justice the top of the wedding cake cases. You know, a wedding cake is tiered. It's very few cases that sit there at the top of that wedding cake, at the very pinnacle, and receive all of the attention and media exposure. And those kind of cases are the Conrad Murray trial, the Casey Anthony trial, and you almost always either have a celebrity or a very attractive white woman involved in those cases. And that attractive white woman can either be the victim, or sometimes she's the perpetrator in the case of Casey Anthony. And I think we might have a very similar case this year with Jodi Arias. It has all the trappings of a top of the wedding cake type of trial.
Why don't you explain what Jodi Arias is, please?
Yeah, Jodi Arias has been charged with murdering her ex-boyfriend in murder in the first degree, and he was shot. He was stabbed 27 times, and his throat was slashed. So whoever did this to him was definitely ticked off. And she's a very attractive young woman. She's presents herself as extremely demure, a choir singer. So it has all of the trappings once again of a very high profile case. And that's to begin later this year. And I think that the point, Susan, and you and I have talked about this before, is that when these individual cases receive so much attention, it's at the detriment of so many other cases out there that deserve our concern and attention, and they often involve people of color, people who aren't quite the Vogue magazine cover people, you know, and it's wrong, you know, but that's what sells. That's what sells magazines. That's what gets people to tune in.
So we're selling crime. And it's interesting that the other night I spoke to a forensic pathologist, and he made an interesting point about Whitney Houston. And
mm-hmm.
This person said to me, he goes, you know, and his brother happens to be or was part of the investigatory team on this. And he said, interestingly enough, that her skin, the way that it pulled away, and it was a
mm-hmm.
fresh autopsy,
mm-hmm.
denoted that she was dead before this, and that somebody may have placed her in the tub in the scalding hot water, you know, because we can't feel the temperature.
Mm-hmm.
We have no basis when we put our hand under it. And he said that was his red flag, that when he learned that her skin had pulled away, it was not right. It was going in after the fact. And he said, this raises flags for me. This to me that perhaps someone possibly could have, she died in another location in the where she was at, and that afterwards they put her in the tub.
Mm-hmm.
And how likely is it, because she had very little water in her lung,
mm-hmm.
and that would have just kind of crept through afterwards. But he said, you know, he was wondering what would happen with that, why more people weren't jumping up and down, and if, in fact, because of all the prescription drugs that she was on, if we might see Michael Jackson again in this case, if people are going to start, you know, it's too soon, will we see that? But will we see you know, so many things in question at the fresh autopsy that didn't make sense. Is the case closed, or do you think that it's going to be reopened and it's going to be a bombshell?
Well, you bring up a very good point. I mean, the media went out of the way, went out of their way to present Whitney Houston as you know, essentially this out of control junkie, and therefore the perception is, well, she was not in the right mind. So you could end up in a situation of victim blaming. So that if there was culpability here, if this is, you know, fact plausible, if there is a possibility that there was foul play, then the public's less likely to believe it or be interested in it, simply by the way the whole thing's been framed by the press, that she was this, you know, down and out junkie essentially. And
because what hasn't come out, and this is what he also shared with me, there are a lot of multi-million-dollar life insurance policies attached to her.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there is something there that isn't right, and no one's talking about that.
That's a very good point. Sure, absolutely. I think the point that you're making here is that the way that the media, the angle, or we call it the frame, the way that it's presented to the public makes all the difference. Because do you have sympathy for this person, or do you blame this person? Do you have resentment? And it's all about how the story is told. I mean, if you just look at, you know, I know our topic here isn't politics, but depending upon how you look at a story, if you listen to the same thing presented, say, on MSNBC versus Fox News, the same political issue, it's going to sound like a completely different story simply by the angle that it's given. So that's what we're talking about here. You know, is this case presented in a fashion that we're supposed to have compassion for the individual, or are we supposed to have antipathy toward the individual? And it
so,
really makes all the difference.
So has the media taken the trust of the public that we grew up with and turned it and spun it to dollars and cents, and what drives those dollars and cents to the revenue, which is the advertisers, more so than telling the truth in the story and delivering the news?
If I had to reduce it to one word, I would say yes. We live in an age where there is just 24/7 ubiquitous news coverage. Constantly, 24 hours a day, and there's so much competition, and the only way to get someone to tune in to your network versus another is really to be more outrageous than the other, and that's why we have so much sensationalism. And as I know you know, Susan, and I'm sure your listeners are aware as well, that this is what generates advertising revenue. The larger your audience, the more you can charge for the advertising. Therefore, it's in your best interest to sensationalize and make it as dramatic and juicy, I guess you would say, as possible. I would say that in many, many cases that any notion of objectivity just goes out the window. It's about selling a story. It's about packaging it up in an entertaining and sensationalized way. And it is news entertainment. It's not objective reporting. It's really about entertainment.
And so if you look at when somebody comes back or they're released from prison, or, you know, the young girl in Italy who was charged, her name just went blank. And Bremner was her lawyer, and she was, you know, in jail for murder.
Mm-hmm,
You know, there's this big book deal now when she comes back. This,
right.
So are we rewarding bad behavior? In one way, you know, people had jumped up and down saying that there'd be a lot of money, at, you know, depending on the verdict in the Anthony trial, and they've gotten knocked down. But yet we still drive that. Drew Peterson, who is in jail awaiting trial for Kathleen Savio. He's a Bolingbrook police officer whose wife was found in a dry bathtub on March 1st, 2004. And it's only when Stacy Peterson goes missing on October 28th, 2007, two and two together, which is what they should have done before, in my opinion. And then, you know, he drove what took place. Now there was a movie that re-aired over the weekend called Untouchable with Rob playing his lead. But what I was saddened by was that I did not see anything afterwards about her being missing or information if you're a victim or where the information you could find about her perhaps to participate in the search. And because she, in my opinion, was a victim, Lifetime aired the movie. They produced it based off of Joe Hosey's book, Fatal Vows, the tragic lives of Drew Peterson. So I was kind of incensed over the weekend because the Google searches, because my blog anyway, went over the top. It crashed back because of the hits after the movie. People were going to look through this, and I didn't figure out what was going on until I learned that the movie had replayed again. But there was nothing afterwards. So it's okay to make money, yes, but she's still missing. So the Google search terms were, what has Peterson been found, you know, 2012, or, you know, what happened to Stacy Peterson found. Those were what seemed to be the search terms. And I think that when you have cases like this, it's not that you have an obligation, but at least if you're going to do this, and if you're especially a women's kind of network, that you do a little bit more, because that movie has generated quite a bit of dollars. Also should generate quite a bit of awareness. And I don't see that from the network, whether you're Lifetime, whether you're CNN, whether you're MSNBC. Is there a reason for that, do you think?
Sure. And I think it's as simple, once again, as greed. It's not about helping the public. It's not about solving social problems from the standpoint of the networks. It's about advertising revenue. It's about profitability. You're absolutely right. Any one of these made-for-television movies or documentaries on a particular case could very easily spend a few minutes at the beginning and the end saying, these are important topics. For more information, contact these groups. If you believe that you're at risk or you know someone at risk, here's a hotline to contact. Of course they could do that, but they just don't. And again, I argue that it's simply profitability. It's greed that is the overriding consideration. And you know, don't get me wrong. I mean, we live in a capitalist system. This is the way the marketplace. This is the way it works. And these are for-profit companies, and they have shareholders to answer to. But there's also the issue of morality, and I believe, and I know you feel this way as well, Susan, is that, you know, we're here on the planet, and I believe that the greatest thing we can do is help one another and be of service, and so can entertain and still provide meaningful information and service to the community. And what you were just describing made me think of the Lacey Peterson case from a few years ago, Scott Peterson. And what never came out, and this is a very, very sad reality, is that the number one cause of death among pregnant women is murder by the father of the child. That's been far and away the number one cause of death among pregnant women. Now, that's exactly what happened in the Scott Peterson case, but that could have been information that would have been very useful to the public and an important topic to discuss. But instead, it ended up being about Scott Peterson, the ladies' man, and he spent more time talking about how he looked in court and women who were writing letters from all over the world of marriage proposals, and it became a circus. And it could have been handled a very different way.
Same thing with Belinda Temple. She was 8 months pregnant. David Temple in Texas was her husband. Catherine Casey wrote the book Shattered, and he murders her. And she's having an affair. He's having an affair. And during the trial, a lot of things didn't come up. In the retrial, he finally got sentenced. It's interesting to me that his mistress, who became his wife, is raising the couple's son from Belinda and David's first marriage. How that happens, I don't know, but that didn't come out either. She was pregnant. He shoots her in the closet. He's a football star. So the whole trial, the football star. And this woman who is having an affair with him is a school teacher, of all things. You know, what is in the mind, and we don't talk about this very much, of somebody who is with someone who that they may suspect has committed a crime? Like you said, all those people, which is a very interesting point, they were writing to Scott Peterson, professor of love, saying, you know, I'll get Drew Peterson in Illinois after Stacy was missing. A woman by the name of Christina Raines, who has two small children, no brains, pilot flying that girl's plane, and she moves in with him, with those two children, knowing what is the excitement of that, that thrill kill? Because, oh, well, the public eye is so much on this, nothing's going to happen to me. I would have thought that not a hair on Stacy Peterson's head would have been harmed based on what she knew. I was very surprised when she turned up missing. I was very surprised when Peterson basically served the country toast for breakfast by coming up with a story that was beyond the truth and that he felt he could get away with it. And they all, these killers, and if you put them together, Doc Bond, they have some handbook somewhere in the sky because they come up with the same answer, the same response. She left. She walked out. Can't they come up with something different? Can't they come up with something more unique? There's you know, a trial right now going on, and it's an officer and his former his wife who's now deceased. But, you know, he shoots her three times and takes her life. And it was very sad to me to see that in the fact that he has more rights than she does. She's dead. And the fact that no one really said when Lisa Nettle Peterson, her name happens to be Peterson, was in Muncie, Indiana. It was June 3rd of 2011. He was claiming it was self-defense. Now, she was shot three times. Two children were taken to the school bus, but there was one in the car who could hear his mother scream for her life. And she had a defensive wound. And her injury could have been, there were 17 minutes between the firing of the three shots and the time that it took for this bozo to call 911. And just, he let her bleed out. And the pathologist who testified at the trial last week, because this is going on now, said the victim's leg wounds were caused by a single bullet. It could have been inflicted, and maybe after she even fell to the floor. She was leaving him. He said to her, "Sorry, you either come back or it's over with for you. Basically, you're going to leave in a body bag." And when, you know, these mothers, these women are no match for these trained killers. And whether you're a police officer or not, it doesn't matter. They seem to have this plan. And it was interesting to me that the defense attorney, you know, after last week said that he wanted a mistrial declared because of the child's testimony. The prosecutor had said, you know, the child had said, "My mom, you could hear her scream for her life as the bullets, you know, were being fired." He wanted the mistrial. They said no. And then all of a sudden he called in a sick day. And, you know, he got her off because, you know, it's like, get real. These offenders seem to have so many rights. I know that we have a justice system, and I know it's maybe too late to try to revamp things, but you have all of these people. It's like the missing. It's like those that are killed. If that person is the last person to see them, like Baby Lisa and these other cases, then there should be some accountability, especially when the child is under a certain age. It's like if you and I had children and the child didn't go to school, we would get ticketed and brought in and charged as a parent. So is there a way perhaps to do that with these parents who seemingly are killing their toddler, early, you know, their young children? And coming up with the excuse saying, "Oh, I don't know what happened." I can't fathom that.
Yes, well, there's so much child abuse out there, and it's estimated that there's a couple of million cases every year But as you so aptly said, so many of these cases go undetected and unreported as well. And it's because you're dealing with issues of parents and children and issues of privacy. These are difficult things to delve into. And it also made me think about about domestic violence. You know, for many years, the police didn't even want to get involved in domestic violence cases. They considered it people's private matters. And what would happen? They would go to the same house every Friday night, and you'd have a situation: the guy gets drunk and he's beating on his wife or girlfriend, and they take him outside and try to cool him off, and then he goes back inside. The pattern continues, and months or years later, she ends up dead. And it was through victim advocates, as you know, that we now have mandatory arrest laws in all 50 states. And it's designed specifically to stop that cycle of violence and separate these individuals so that the violence doesn't escalate. But don't you think, though,
that with the mandatory arrest, sometimes in some cases it hurts the victim because it's a double-edged sword? She has no means to facilitate bond. He has the method to do so. She doesn't. Sometimes it seems to be, we'll just arrest both of them because we just don't want to deal with this, rather than responding to what I feel is a crime scene and treating it as such.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. It's certainly not a perfect situation. You're absolutely right, and it's a similar situation with children as well. You know, these are complicated situations. I've talked to many police officers who have said when they go into a domestic violence situation, it's very, very difficult to even determine what's happening. Sometimes both people are bleeding, you know, and it's hard to determine what exactly is going on. And you add substance, you add alcohol, you add drugs, and it's a very, very complicated situation. And I don't envy law enforcement in those kind of situations. But you made me think when we were talking before about culpability and also responsibility, and so many criminals, even truly psychopathic criminals like some serial killers and serial rapists, even though they don't have remorse per se, they don't feel a sense of shame or guilt about their crimes, it doesn't mean they still don't go to great extents to try to neutralize their guilt or justify it. And they have all sorts of what we call neutralization techniques. And they can be as simple as, she had it coming, look at the way she dressed, she shouldn't talk that way to me, she knows how I am when I'm drunk, she should just leave me alone, all sorts of things. And it's very, very common, even for truly psychopathic killers, to try to deflect the blame in some way. And some serial killers will even allude to some sort of a outside power that takes control of them. We call it denial of responsibility. And they will say that some force takes over them. BTK, for example, bind, torture, kill, strangler, would refer to it as factor X. He would say that something literally would take over him, and so therefore, I mean, he wouldn't say this, but essentially what his message was is, how can I be responsible when some force is taking over me? So
isn't that what Charles Manson did or said? I mean, he's up for parole this year.
Yeah, that's right, and for the umpteenth time, and he'll never get parole, but he's alluded to that. David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, of course, has...
Well, why don't we tell you, we should tell our listeners that you are pen pals with Dennis Rader and David Berkowitz. And what made you do that? These are two notorious serial killers. They're both going to die in prison for the crimes that they committed. Why did you choose or select these two to correspond with?
Well, what I'm working on is research that is about the public's fascination with serial killers. And I wanted to get I wanted to get firsthand information about from the lips of serial killers and the workings of their minds, and because the serial killers have become almost like a pop culture commodity, and some of them have become so over the top sensationalized, like Bundy, and even as far back as Jack the Ripper.
Well, Bundy had claimed that pornography made him do it. Henry Lee Lucas blamed it on his upbringing. I think Dahmer said that he was born with a part of him missing somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby Joe Long said a motorcycle accident made him hypersexual and eventually a serial lust killer.
Mm-hmm.
John Wayne Gacy. It was
the
interesting that one of the kids that he kills, Greg Godzik, is who I go to school with.
Mm-hmm.
And he ends up missing, and his friend, one of his friends, because we all hung out together, and this kid was a class clown, and he was somebody that kind of did drugs himself, and no one believed him when he said something's happened to Greg.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that all these years later, that I would act with him, and he said he's finally clean and sober, because he went into just the dark pit when he just couldn't live with himself, and because he felt that he could have saved Greg Godzik, and he was a young man, 16 years old, you know, a brand new car. He was working in construction, probably a mile away from where I lived, and nobody ever thought about it. And then for it to come back all these years later, and literally, there were a bunch of us, I think it was 1977 or 78, we had coffee, it was freezing cold, it was January, and we didn't understand how it looked like, there were numbers on, marker numbers, where there were skeletal remains, and they had the garage door off, and they were getting ready to, bag and tag.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't realize the magnitude of what this was. I mean, this guy used to come into the drugstore where I used to sell him gum and candy. And, nobody ever thought about him. He was just John Gacy.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't dawn on me because of social media till later on how close this guy lived to me. Close. He was in the drugstore where I worked when I was a kid. And he was like just around the corner. And how many kids applied for jobs, for construction, and how many didn't make it out. And now they're talking about the fact that perhaps there are other bodies. And that seemingly he begins a normal life and a marriage with children.
Yeah.
And yet,
it's actually not that uncommon. And that is what you're describing, Susan, is the truly psychopathic mind. And John Wayne Gacy, the killer, also known as the killer clown, because he used to dress up in clown costume to entertain children at hospitals. He had this compartmentalized dual life. On the one hand, he was the civic leader. He's the president of the JCs. He had this seemingly completely normal life, and yet he was just murdering and destroying the lives of young men, and for whom he had a sexual fantasy. And it gets to the very question, and you ask me why I'm interested in this and why I'm writing a book about it. It's really more about the public's fascination with these individuals, and I must admit that I do have as a criminologist and also as just a person, I find the horrific deeds of these individuals just so incomprehensible, and that I want to know why. And the more that I talk to people and the more research that I do, I find that other people have that same interest. They just cannot comprehend how one human being can do these sorts of things to another, and especially almost always they're complete strangers. Serial killers are not like other murderers. They tend to stalk and kill individuals who are complete strangers, whereas most homicides, the vast majority of all homicides, in fact, are committed by one person who knows the other individual, and in many cases is even intimately involved. So serial killers
are
very much...
They have not found, for instance, the Zodiac killers and the ABC killers, and What's interesting about that is think of the time when these murders occurred and there was social media. Did these individuals, perhaps, in your opinion, go to the library and order periodicals or look at, ask for certain subscriptions to where these crimes took place so that they could keep tabs on them? You know, and it seemed to me in these killings that the killers then seemed to make the accessibility of finding the, their victims rather than now where at the Long Island serial killers in New York, they, you know, they've been buried for a long time, had to be dug up, whereas in these killings they seem to allow the family to find them, whereas in other killings now it seems of late that's not the case. Is there a correlation there? Is it because of the time that we live in?
Well, I think that, that like any individual or any phenomenon, it evolves as technology evolves. So, yes, serial killers are likely to utilize technology. Many of them are students of the game, and by what I mean by that is they actually study each other. David Berkowitz, for example, had books on other serial killers, and so they learn from one another. And I mean, this is, it's an obsession. Killing becomes an obsession with these people, so they literally study it, and the ones who are these systematic, what we call organized killers, the true planners and meticulous ones like Bundy and the Long Island serial killer, I believe, falls into this category. They're meticulous planners, so they're very adept with technology. They're very adept with social media. I've heard serial killers describe, and this is before, let's say, the internet or before social media, how they would simply stalk individuals. They would literally just, you know, follow them down the street. They'd sit outside and watch their house to learn their patterns. It's part of the, yeah, I mean, it's very disturbing, but it's part of the fantasy. It's part of the buildup, part of the excitement for them to stalk and to prey and to plan. It's a, it's a sense of excitement for them. And so the killing may be the ultimate culmination of the fantasy, but there's oftentimes a prelude to it and a buildup to the actual killing.
What defines a serial killer?
Well, the actual definition, this is the FBI definition, Susan, is killing a minimum of three individuals in three separate events with an emotional cooling off period in between the killings so that the individual, the killer, blends back into their seemingly normal life. And that distinguishes a serial killer from, say, a spree killer who might kill three people but in a very, very short period of time, over the course of one day or 2 days. That would actually be a spree killing. So somebody like a Bundy or a Berkowitz that kills over a longer period of time would fall into that category. And then the third that's sometimes confused with either a serial killer or a spree killer is a mass murderer. And that's someone who, like Columbine or Virginia Tech, where many people are killed or multiple people are killed in one episode. And those individuals are often either killed or often will even turn the gun on themselves in those incidents, in mass murders. That's a slightly different thing. Some years ago, before the term serial killer was actually coined, and it was coined back in around the 1970s is when that term really came into common use, they were referred to as mass murderers before then.
What's their background? What kind of background do these have? Are they mostly males? Are they, you know, is it a mix of people? Are they, and then what's their ages?
We need another hour for this one, Susan. there's this notion. There's almost this. It is. It's a popular myth that it's this white 30-something male who is very much of a loner and lives out in the woods in a house by himself, and that's part of popular mythology. And there are certainly serial killers who fit that bill, but they come in all shapes, sizes, colors, and even genders. There are female serial killers, and about 15%, as a matter of fact, of all serial killers are women. And there are also serial killers who are people of color. Latinos and black serial killers. But as I think you and I have talked about before, the reason that we don't hear so much about those individuals, particularly the minority serial killers, is they tend to kill people of their same race. And the stories that become high-profile stories, news stories, crime stories in the United States, are when white people are killed. And white serial killers tend to kill white victims, and particularly attractive white women. And that's what makes the news. There was a serial killer who killed at least four prostitutes in the Detroit area back in December, right before the holidays. And I saw one article, actually, you and I talked about it, and there's been very little since. And any time that they're minority victims, you just don't see the same level of attention paid to it by the media.
Hypothetically, let me just, you know, Andrea Yeager killed her five children. Can we define her as a serial of more than one? So why do we look at...
She killed all of her children at the same time, however.
Okay. So that's different.
So the thing that defines a serial killer, and it's really, really important, is that emotional cooling off period in between. Because serial killers, they're killing for a different reason. Someone like who snaps and becomes a mass murderer and goes and and kills a group of people at a restaurant or a bank or something like that, and then turns the gun on themselves. They're killing for a different reason. They had, in all likelihood, a psychotic break, a break from reality, and they just lashing out in violence. Serial killers are killing because they have this need to kill, and the need is satisfied partially by the planning and the preparation and the all of the meticulous organization that's required to carry it out. And that's also what makes them so difficult to apprehend, the Bundys and the BTKs.
So the Columbine kids, though, the Columbine kids, they methodically planned this out. Do you think that maybe in that case that somebody could have noticed something, a family member, other kids, and they just were afraid to say, or they just couldn't identify?
Sure, or denial, you know, simply not wanting to see it, you know. The answer is there probably were signs, and if someone had paid close enough attention, they could have seen it. But once again, the thing that I would love to impress upon your listeners is that there is no one-size-fits-all with serial killers. They are very diverse. Their motivations are very different. Some of them actually feel tremendous remorse. There was a guy by the name of Robert Shulman who killed prostitutes in the 90s at the same time that Joel Rifkin was also killing prostitutes, and Rifkin was the one who got most of the headlines. But Shulman killed five prostitutes, but he suffered tremendous remorse. And I mean, he loathed himself, and yet he was compelled to kill. He was driven to kill, and yet he just absolutely despised himself for doing it. Whereas true sociopathic killers like Bundy and John Wayne Gacy are able to kill and then go home and sit down with their family and have dinner and sleep like a baby at night because they are just disconnected emotionally from their actions.
You know, I think what would be fascinating, there is a man by the name of Donald Lang who was a deaf mute, and he killed in the 70s. He killed prostitutes. His mother had died around this time, and I only know about this case because my dad. My father was in, it's called the dactology, to be able to communicate with somebody who can't hear. And at the time, there were very few people who could interpret, and they had called my dad in, and he was in court, and he told Donald Lang in sign language he could go home to show the courts that he understood. Mm-hmm. And they lost those transcripts, and the man by the name of Lowell Meyer was representing him. Mm-hmm. And he got off only to come out and kill again. And I had to do a paper for school on it, or I decided to do one. What I got out of doing the paper, and LeVar Burton had played the movie Donald Lang, was that he was killing women close to his mother's age in grief. I know that sounds crazy, but that was my theory. And I don't know if it's right or wrong, but to me, because he grew up deaf. He grew up, as they said, deaf and dumb back then.
And
he used it and got away with it and got outside, but only to kill again. And they had found his victim's underwear in the closet and some other things. And, you know, to kill again on the south side, now to put away, you know, I found it fascinating because he couldn't hear. So what kind of serial killer is that kills so many women and, you know, involvement in so many, who has a disability? Does it matter?
Well, once again, you really have to look into the pathology of it, as well as the environmental circumstances. I believe, and now not everyone who studies these things necessarily has the same opinion on all this, but I believe that these individuals, serial killers, are a combination of their environment, their upbringing, as well as the way that their brains are wired at birth. And they're different, you know. There are people who suffer abuse as a child, but they don't grow up to be serial killers. There are people who have psychological problems, perhaps are wired a little bit differently at birth, who don't grow up to become serial killers. But I liken it to almost like a perfect storm, where it's a combination of nature and nurture that comes together, and then there's some trigger that sets them off. And once they're set off, they're off and running. And there's no putting Jack back into the box at that point.
No. What about Richard Speck from the 60s? To me, he always fascinated me because it was the first time probably you and I ever saw somebody like that on television who had killed all those nurses.
Yeah.
And his brain, are we studying or are you looking at how these individuals grow up, their family environments?
Well, I think interesting for your listeners. I think it's important to make a distinction between a sociopath and a psychopath. These are not mental illnesses per se. They're not, if you look at the, in the medical books under sociopathy and psychopathy, they're not mental illnesses like something like schizophrenia or psychosis. What they are is they're antisocial personality disorders, and there's really no treatment for them. There's no drug treatment. There's no therapy. There's no treatment that we know of. And the difference between the two is psychopaths like a Ted Bundy or a John Wayne Gacy are just disconnected. Imagine like the cable from your television in the wall. You pull it out of the wall and you just get no reception. Well, that's a psychopath. There's just no emotional connection whatsoever. There's no empathy. They're just a blank screen. But what makes them so scary and so manipulative and so hard to detect is they're very good at mimicking emotion. They observe, they know what the right reaction is, and they're able to mimic it, but they don't actually feel it. And that, of course, is a very chilling thing to comprehend. The sociopath, on the other hand, is a bit different. That same cord, Susan, that's in the wall, with a sociopath, it's a disconnect. It's the cord is in the wall, but it shorts out from time to time. And so there are times when a sociopath actually does have empathy and the ability to connect with others, and then there are other times where there is just no disconnect, or there is a complete disconnect. And so sociopaths actually tend to be more volatile. They tend to be more excitable, nervous, and because they've got all this angst and this energy. And they're actually a little bit easier to detect because they're likely to have mood swings and act out violently in public. So a sociopath is actually easier to see, and they're also more common. And so a sociopath is actually more likely to be your crazy next-door neighbor who's fighting with you, for example. True psychopaths are much more rare.
In the book that you're working on, because there's such a fascination with this. Is that why you're corresponding? Have you learned anything interesting about Rader and Berkowitz? And you're being pen pals with them, basically.
Well, I at the risk of being coy, I have to say I really can't go into too many details about the specific discourse right now due to some confidentiality. But I will tell you the reason that I'm interested in this, and that is I want to try to explain to the public and why we have this fascination. And I think, as I said, that I'm not the only one. I believe that people want to know why these individuals kill. I think that there's, to a certain extent, I believe that serial killers are a commodification. They are entertainment. You look at Dexter, you know, a TV show that's about a serial killer. Now he's an avenging angel serial killer, but he's a serial killer. Hannibal Lecter has become a pop culture icon, and he's a cannibal serial killer, a horrible human being, and yet he's a huge public icon and almost like an anti-hero. Now, why is that? And I think, well, there's a public fascination with this dark side, the evil. You know, it begs to ask us, you know, what am I capable of, you know, under certain circumstances? Could I do something like that? And I think the public simply wants to know. And but it's I really believe, my research and the conversations that I'm having, even just with the public, people who are interested in these things, it seems to me. And the news goes toward making this a reality, that it almost doesn't matter whether it's a real serial killer like a Long Island serial killer or a Ted Bundy or a Hannibal Lecter or a Dexter. It's all entertainment until that individual shows up in your life. You know, once the Long Island serial killer kills your sister or your next door neighbor, then it becomes real. But until then, it's just more fodder. It's more entertainment value, and that's more of a statement about society and about the media than it is even about the killers themselves.
The Anthony Bruno, who's an author, best-selling author, wrote the book *The Iceman: The True Story of Cold-Blooded Killer* of Robert Kukulinski, who claimed to kill over 100 people. So,
mm-hmm.
How does that, he's a serial killer, he cools down even though it's for hire,
mm-hmm.
He kills all these people, why don't we call those mob-related individuals serial killers?
Great question, and there's a little bit of debate even among experts on this, whether hitmen, you know, so-called, you know, mob hitmen should be considered serial killers. Now the Iceman is a little bit different. He's almost like a hybrid, because in as much as he killed for hire, for the mob, he also killed just for his own pleasure and his own reasons.
But isn't it
really
interesting? He claimed, because he was abused and had such a bad life,
mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Also he was related to somebody that had also killed. So he
yes.
was saying, you know, well, look at my life. I mean, come on.
Well, he almost
a perfect example.
He found what he did is he found a career that suited him. You know, he wanted to kill. He wanted to strike back at society. And in many cases, serial killer, not all, but with many serial killers, it is a rage towards society that they're acting out on. John Wayne Gacy was an example of that, acting out at rage. Joel Rifkin was acting out at rage at society and found a way to do it. And so, in the case of the Iceman, in a way, in a very twisted sort of logic, he found the perfect career for someone who wanted to kill. You know, why not become a professional killer? Susan, I don't know if you saw this in the news a few weeks ago. There's a disturbing case out in California with an Iraqi vet who has become a serial killer, killed a number of homeless men out in Los Angeles, and the reason that he did it, this is his justification. He was trained to be a sniper, an expert sniper, and he was sent over to Iraq. But when he got over there, instead of letting him be a sniper, they made him a truck driver. And he was so upset that he wasn't allowed to do what he was sent there to do. He believed that he was this perfect weapon that needed to kill. So he came back from Iraq dissatisfied and believing that the government had essentially taken advantage of him. So he needed to kill. So he became a serial killer. And the way he justified it in his own mind, and this is his justification, is that homeless men are worthless. So he was, in fact, doing society a favor by exterminating these homeless men in Los Angeles. So he acted out on his own need, which was to kill, but then he neutralized his guilt by saying these guys deserve to die anyway, so we should, in fact, thank him for his, you know, for his work.
Do you think that when they're arrested finally and caught, that they take a breather like, oh, gosh, thank you? You know, is there some part of them, not for feeling any remorse for what they did, but it's a game to them until they are apprehended? It's a catch-me-if-you-can mentality. It is the world against that individual. Is that part of someone who is a serial killer? Is that their makeup?
Well, there are serial killers who certainly do enjoy the cat and mouse game, the catch me if you can aspect of it. And I, in fact, think that the Long Island serial killer falls into that category. And, you know, you and I discussed before how he taunted the sister of one of the victims with the cell phone of the victim herself. And so I think he falls into that category. I think many times serial killers are another myth is that they're caught because they want to get caught, and I don't believe that that is true. I think what happens is sometimes they get sloppy, and if you kill 10, 15, 20 people, as some of these individuals do, I hate to put it this way, but it becomes a bit mundane, and they become a little bit sloppy, and that's how Joel Rifkin was killed, by driving around with a decomposing body in his trunk, and he was pulled over for a minor traffic violation. So,
well, look at the movie Psycho. Look at how Hitchcock uses Janet Leigh, and mm-hmm. and the character, and when he's finally apprehended, but is he apprehended? He's out back again to kill again. That was the most horrific movie, I think, of its time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I think that we need to talk about the Long Island serial killers. We haven't even gotten to that. So why don't we do part two next week with you, if you're available, same time, same place.
Sure.
Okay. And this way we can go into more of these individuals, and I really wanted to talk about the Long Island serial killer, and Denny Griffin will be back next week. So thank you to the Crime Wire team, our director of research, Tim Colton, and public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday, April 17th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice. And I think that everybody needs to go to www.docbon.com, his site. He writes a blog a few days a week. It is amazing. And again, thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We appreciate your support, value as guests. If you'd like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, then email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. You can hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show simply by going to www.crimewireblogspot.com. Turn the volume of your computer and your show will automatically play. We are grateful for Dr. Scott Bond, who we will have back with us here next week. Visit our website, thecrimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Dan Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano. God bless everybody and have a safe week. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
All right. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.